Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight, we're very thrilled to welcome back to the store award-winning author Neal Stephenson. He's the winner of the Hugo Award, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, the Locus Award, the Prometheus Award, and a whole lot of other awards, even ones you make up in your head every time you read his books, because you just want to give him more awards because they're that great. We're just so excited to have him here tonight to discuss and sign his new book, Seven Eves. Please join me giving a warm welcome to Neal Stephenson.
Thanks, and thanks for coming out. When I was a kid, I used to ride my bike down to the bookmobile in Ames, Iowa, and check out the latest science fiction book every week. And at some point, I checked out a book whose author and title I have unfortunately forgotten, but it was a space arc book. It was about a global catastrophe that forced the people of Earth to get together and build a big arc and send a few people into space. And I guess it made a big impression on me because now I've got a space arc novel of my own. It's called Seven Eves. It's right here. Took me quite a while to come out with it. That's partly because in order to write a new contribution to the space arc subgenre, you have to come up with a disaster scenario that is very finely calibrated. If an asteroid comes out of nowhere tomorrow and destroys everything on the Earth, I can't make an arc novel out of that because we wouldn't have time to build an arc. And if there's a slow-rolling disaster that takes 100 or 200 years to materialize, then we wouldn't build an arc. We would just solve the problem. So it's got to be obvious. It's got to be predictable long enough in advance that we have time to build an arc, but not so long that we would just do something else. So it took me a long time to find something that would work for that. The scenario I came up with is based on some real research that's been done about the problem of space junk. So people have been going into space now for long enough that we've littered low Earth orbit with a fairly large number of spent rocket boosters and dead satellites and things that astronauts dropped on their spacewalks. And these things are all moving around up there at extremely high velocities, and every so often, just at random, two of them will bang into each other. And usually what they do at that point is shatter into many smaller fragments that all spray off on different orbits. And the specter has been raised by experts in this kind of thing that this could sort of go exponential, and we could have more collisions leading to more pieces leading to more collisions, and suddenly we would have so much junk in space that we wouldn't be able to go up there and use space in the way that we're accustomed to. That got me thinking about trying to use that basic idea to come up with an arc-compliant space disaster. And the one thing I knew was that space junk alone was not going to work because there's not enough of it to kill everybody. So you would have to have a whole lot of rocks up there, or a whole lot of something up there, in order to turn that into the kind of thing that would force us to build an arc. So I ended up blowing up the moon. The first thing that happens in this book, page one, first sentence, is that the moon blows up for no apparent reason and fills the – well, initially it doesn't fill the sky, but it breaks up into seven major chunks that all kind of are milling around up there, still orbiting in the same orbit that the moon used to have and sort of occasionally bumping into each other. So one of our main characters in the book is a guy named Dubois Jerome Xavier Harris, who is a scientist. He's a an astrophysicist at Caltech who also is a science popularizer. So he's one of those people who can write scientific papers that are authoritative, but he can also go on the Today Show and talk and tweet about science. So his phone rings when the moon blows up and keeps ringing for a while, and he's trying to explain. He's trying to calm people down. There's no explanation for why it happened. It's a great mystery, but he's trying to get people to kind of chill out and see it as a scientific phenomenon. And one of the things he does is that he gives the seven big rocks names. He doesn't want to call them names like Nemesis and Thor, so he calls them Potato Head, Mr. Spinny, Acorn, Peach Pit, Scoop, Big Boy, and Kidney Bean. And that works until about a week into the situation when two of them bang into each other and Kidney Bean breaks in half. So now we've got eight pieces. And that sort of turns on something in his scientist brain and gets him to thinking. So we take up the action about 4 days later. He's talking to the president of the United States and her advisors at Camp David. So I'm just going to read for about 10 minutes or something. "We need to stop asking ourselves what happened and start talking about what is going to happen," Dr. Harris said to the President of the United States, her science advisor, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and about half of the cabinet. He could see that the president didn't like that, Julia Bliss Flaherty, currently nearing the end of her first year on that job. The chairman of the JCS was nodding, but President Flaherty was giving him a hard, squinting look, and not just because of the light coming in the window from the skies over Camp David. She thought he was up to something, trying to shift blame, trying to push some kind of new agenda. "Go on," she said, then remembering her manners, "Dr. Harris." 4 days ago, I watched kidney beans break in half," Dube said. "The seven sisters became eight. Since then, we've seen a near miss that could have fractured Mr. Spinney." "I would almost welcome it," said the president, "if we could get rid of those ridiculous names." "It'll happen," Dube said. "The question is, how long does Mr. Spinney have to live? And what does that tell us?" He clicked a small remote in his hand and brought up a slide on the big screen. Heads turned toward it, and he felt a mild sense of relief at not being stared at anymore by the president. The slide was a montage of a snowball rolling down a hill, a fuzzy bacterial culture growing in a petri dish, a mushroom cloud, and other seemingly unrelated phenomena. "What do all of these have in common?" "They're exponential," he said. "The word gets tossed around a lot by people who use it to mean anything that's getting big fast, but it has a specific mathematical meaning. It means any process where the more it happens, the more it happens. The population explosion, a nuclear chain reaction, a snowball rolling down a hill whose speed of growth is pegged to how much it's grown." He clicked through another slide showing plots of exponential curves on a graph, then to an image of the moon's eight pieces. "When the moon had only one piece, the probability of a collision was zero," he said. "Because there was nothing to collide with," Pete Starling, the president's science advisor, explained. The president nodded. "Thank you, Dr. Starling. When you have two pieces, why then, yes, they can collide. The more pieces you get, the higher the chances of any two pieces banging into each other. But what happens when they bang into each other?" He clicked the control again and showed a little movie of Kidney Bean's breakup. "Well, sometimes, but not always, they break in half, which means you have more pieces, eight instead of seven, nine instead of eight, and that increase in number means an increase in the odds of further collisions." "It's an exponential," said the chairman. "It occurred to me 4 days ago that it did have all the earmarks of an exponential process," Dube allowed, "and we know what happens to those." President Flaherty had been watching him intently, but she now flicked her eyes over at Pete Starling, who made a dramatic upward-zooming gesture with one hand, tracing the profile of a hockey stick. When an exponential hits the bend in the hockey stick curve, Dube said, the result can be indistinguishable from a detonation, or it can look like a slow, steady increase. It all depends on the time constant, the inherent speed with which the exponential thing happens, and on how we perceive it as humans. So it might be nothing, said the chairman. It could be that 100 years will pass before we go from 8 chunks to 9 chunks, Dube said, nodding at him. But 4 days ago I got worried that it might be one of those things that looks more like an explosion. So my grad students and I have been crunching some numbers, building a mathematical model of the process that we can use to get a handle on the timescale. And what are your results, Dr. Harris? I assume you have some, or else you wouldn't be here. The good news is that the Earth is one day going to have a beautiful system of rings just like Saturn. The bad news is that it's going to be messy. In other words, said Pete Starling, the chunks of the moon are going to keep banging into each other indefinitely and breaking up into smaller and smaller pieces, spreading out into a system of rings. But some rocks are going to fall on the ground and break things. And can you tell me, Dr. Harris, when this is going to happen? Over what period of time? The president asked. We're still gathering data, tuning the model's parameters, Dube said. So my estimates could all be off by a factor of 2, maybe 3. Exponentials are tricky that way. But what it looks like to me is this. He clicked through to a new graph, a blue curve showing a slow, steady climb over time. The time scale at the bottom is something like 1 to 3 years. During that time, the number of collisions and the number of new fragments are going to grow steadily. What is BFR? Asked Pete Starling, for the graph's vertical scale was labeled thus. Bolide fragmentation rate, Dube said, the rate at which new rocks are being produced. Is that a standard term? Pete wanted to know. His tone was not so much hostile as unnerved. No, Dube said. I made it up yesterday on the plane. He was tempted to add something like, I am allowed to coin terms, but didn't want things to get snarky this early in the meeting. Seeing that Pete had been silenced at least for a moment, Dube tried to get back into his rhythm. We'll see an increasing number of meteorite impacts. Some will cause great damage, but overall life is not going to change that much. But then, he clicked again, and the plot bent sharply upward, turning white. We are going to witness an event that I am calling the White Sky. It'll happen over hours or days. The system of discrete planetoids that we can see up there now is going to grind itself up into a vast number of much smaller fragments. They're going to turn into a white cloud in the sky, and that cloud is going to spread out. Click. The graph continued shooting upward, rocketing up into a new domain and turning red. A day or two after the White Sky event will begin a thing I am calling the hard rain, because not all of those rocks are going to stay up there. Some of them are going to fall into the Earth's atmosphere. He turned the projector off. This was an unusual move, but it snapped them all out of PowerPoint hypnosis and forced them to look at him. The aides in the back of the room were still thumbing their phones, but they didn't matter. By some, Dube said, I mean trillions. The room remained silent. It is going to be a meteorite bombardment such as the Earth has not seen since the primordial age when the solar system was formed, Dube said. Those fiery trails we've been seeing in the sky lately, as the meteorites come in and burn up, there will be so many of those that they will merge into a dome of fire that will set aflame anything that can see it. The entire surface of the Earth is going to be sterilized. Glaciers will boil. The only way to survive is to get away from the atmosphere, go underground, or go into space. Well, obviously that is very hard news if it is true, the president said. They all sat and thought about it silently for a period of time that might have been 1 minute or 5. We will have to do both, the president said, go into space and underground. Obviously, the latter is easier. Yes, we can get to work building underground bunkers for... And she caught herself before saying something impolitic. For people to take refuge in. Dube didn't say anything. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, Dr. Harris, I'm an old logistics guy. I deal in stuff. How much stuff do we need to get underground? How many sacks of potatoes and rolls of toilet paper per occupant? I guess what I'm asking is, just how long is the hard rain going to last? Dube said, my best estimate is that it will last somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 years. So that's the basic setup of the book. Thanks. I won't go into a lot more story stuff, so just not to spoil things, but another thing I'll talk about briefly is some illustrations that we had made when I was a kid reading those old science fiction books. I always really dug books with good illustrations, and so for this one, my publisher and I decided to kind of go the extra mile, and we ended up striking a deal with Weta Workshop in New Zealand to make some illustrations. So the front and back end papers of the book both have black and white illustrations that came out of Weta, and then in the about page 600, there's a color insert that is two-sided. It's got a couple more illustrations. And then we were having so much fun that I hired them to do another illustration that was too late to fit into the book, but it just came out on on the web a couple days ago. It was it's a color image that went up on io9 and Gizmodo, and it's going to sort of now go up on the site that we're creating around the book. So pictures. So at this point, I thought we could go to a Q&A format for a while. I've been informed that this thing is being podcast, and so since we lack a microphone for questions, what I'll do is repeat each question before I answer it. So you might want to keep your question short enough that I can remember it. Just a sec, sir. No, that's okay. And then at some point, the staff will let us know when time is up, and then we'll go to book signing. But there's some swag that the publisher sent around, some posters, I guess. And so those are going to be raffled off, and we'll do that during the signing part of the evening, just to make that a little bit less tedious. So yes, go.
I really love your characters.
Oh, thanks.
I wonder if you could talk about how you create them and how they change as you're writing the book.
How do I create my characters, and how do they change as I'm writing the book? I don't know. I'm not good at introspection in my process. I'm afraid if I think about it too hard, it'll stop happening. So, I mean, it's kind of knowing people and having known a lot of people and having read a lot of history and learned about people and how they respond to situations and just being able to kind of put myself in the shoes of an imaginary person for a while. And then how they change over the course of the book, you know, has to do with what's going on in the story. And in a lot of ways, you know, a good story is one that causes changes to happen in a character. You know, in this case, for example, the book is about some enormous challenges that the people of Earth have to overcome in order to keep a small number of people alive. And so it's a lot of engineering stuff. And so the people who populate the book are a lot of scientists and engineers who are having to use their ingenuity and their knowledge and sort of personal qualities like bravery to do what needs to be done. Yes.
Did you give Neil deGrasse Tyson a preview copy of the book? Because he was an awful lot like Dr. Harris.
Did I give Neil deGrasse Tyson a preview copy of the book? No, he's a very busy man. Yeah, yeah, sir. Yeah.
Follow up to the first question, somewhat. Do you make it a point in some of your novels to create an intelligent female role character?
Do I make it a point in some of my novels to create an intelligent female role model kind of character? I don't know. It's I mean, it shouldn't be necessary, right? In a perfect world, it wouldn't be necessary to make a point of it, right? So I'm hoping to get to a place where it doesn't feel like that's a conscious decision. Some of my books have sort of different level of gender balance or imbalance depending on what the book is about. So Anathem, for example, had relatively few female characters because it was about monks. There were female monks too, but the core group of people were dudes. This book, it's the other way around. So the population gets skewed over time more and more towards women. So I try not to be overly pointed or mindful of it, because that kind of approach tends to not lead to good writing. Try to make it into a reasonably natural story. So, okay, so we're going to work our way down the aisle. We're going to begin with you, and then you on that side, and then you. Okay, so go ahead.
This might be a longer question, but I'll try to cut it down. I'm a beginning writer. I like hard science fiction. I was flabbergasted when I was in a science fiction writing group that I would include some bit of extrapolated technology. My thing was mesh networking, ad hoc mesh networking, which actually exists now. Mm-hmm. It's not even extrapolated. But the readers would stop dead in their tracks and say, I don't understand it. I don't know what it is. You lost me there. Mm. And I was so surprised, because I read things all the time that I don't understand.
Yeah.
Like I'm reading Werner Vinge right now.
And you don't stop.
And don't stop. In fact, right. I enjoy it.
Right.
And that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah.
What is going on there? What do you call that? Why do some readers...
Just stop. Why do some readers just stop and throw the book away the first time they encounter something they don't understand? I don't know. I mean, I haven't read your stuff, so I mean it. No, I mean, sorry. There may be something to do with, you know, maybe as part of the process you're going through of learning to write. You know, maybe it's there's some trick you can learn to ease people into it. Like maybe don't use the technical term right away. So, well, then this computer started talking to a bunch of other computers. And then later on, once you've kind of introduced it, you can sort of, and it was called a mesh network, by the way. Or I don't know, just an idea. I think, you know, the culture of science fiction readership is obviously more skewed towards people who like to learn things and who aren't put off by technical stuff. I think there's also, that's also explains techno thrillers a lot. I mean, someone once pointed out during the heyday of Tom Clancy, someone made the point that you could get on the metro in Washington, D.C. and see all these mid-level GS guys sitting there reading Tom Clancy, because they felt at some level that they were learning something. They were like, you know, picking up some, you know, the performance specs of the F/A-18 fighter, or, you know, something like that. And so it wasn't wasted. They weren't merely entertaining themselves, but, you know, they were doing something practical. So I don't know if that helps, but okay. Next aisle person, Plaid. Yeah, you. Have I had trouble publishing books outside of my kind of original home genre of science fiction? I think that my publisher is past surprise at this point. They're just it's like, okay, Neil, whatever, kind of attitude. I think it hasn't been, you know, pushback so much as, you know, surprise, curiosity, okay, we'll try this kind of thing. I think I kind of established a pattern pretty early in my career of doing different stuff each time, and the first time I, you know, did something really new, it worked. I mean, a lot of my readers came along for that ride. And once the publisher saw that, they afterwards felt a lot more comfortable with me zigging and zagging over time. So there was one more. Oh, yeah, there you go.
Just a couple questions about some of the non-novel projects.
Okay.
First off, is Clang happening?
Well, there's an announcement on the site that explains the status of that. So on the it's been shut down because of inability to obtain financing to keep the project going. The team had to go get real jobs. It's a video game project. The film adaptation of Snow Crash is still being whispered about. I mean, you know, sometimes the whispers are louder and sometimes they're softer. And the last few months they've been louder. But, you know, it is, again, anytime you venture outside of writing books, it really is all about financing. So that is a long and winding path that project's been going down for quite a while. But there's no definite news to report on that front. So back there, like me.
I let myself be unconcerned by Gamergate because I'm not a gamer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this is a question about sad puppies and about, you know, if you don't know what that is, good for you. Yeah, I know. I don't know enough of the background to follow it very well. And so what I ended up doing was basically reading George R. R. Martin's blog posts about it, where he kind of goes through and very calmly and, you know, in a civil and kind of reasonable way, kind of works his way through the whole story and evaluates the facts and the historical record. So I basically agree with him. He knows way more about it than I do, about the history and about the people involved and about the genre. He's read all of these books and I haven't. So I sort of defer to him where that is concerned. It's a controversy about the Hugo Awards. So the Hugo Awards, which is sort of, you know, generally, I guess, thought of as the big, the most prestigious, you know, the Oscars of science fiction, if you will, have always been sort of handed out on the basis of it's a complicated system, but it kind of boils down to the honor system, where anybody who signs up for Worldcon, the World Science Fiction Convention, gets a vote. And there's always been a kind of a social contract in place governing kind of the amount of orchestration and campaigning and so on that people do. The social contract has basically kind of been broken now, and it's never going to be unbroken. So they're probably going to have to come up with a new way now to handle the voting for that. So it's one of those classic things that didn't survive the internet. Yes. At the moment I'm reading some Dickens. I'm reading Bleak House. There's one coming out from Austin Grossman pretty soon called Crooked, which is a sort of retelling of the story of Richard Nixon, but with a kind of supernatural angle that none of us saw coming, except for Austin. One of the best novels I've read in the last couple of years is Hild, H-I-L-D, by Nicola Griffith, which is a big book. It's a big historical book about a historical figure in, I think, 7th century Britain, who was came to be regarded as a seer, but it's not a supernatural book. It's not a fantasy book. She's regarded as a seer because she's very observant, and then people kind of map supernatural stuff onto her. So that's a cool book. Way over here, yes. Everyone always looks behind. Yeah.
Would you consider Seven Apes sort of a spiritual successor to an empire?
Would I consider Seven Apes a spiritual successor to Anathem? That's close. I mean, I don't know if I'd exactly put it that way, but the two books have more in common with each other than they do with my other books. So it's a pretty good guess. There was somebody else in that section over there. Yes.
So the time scale covered in your books, with the exception of Greenby, possibly continues to get bigger and bigger. Is that intentional?
The time scale in some of my books gets bigger and bigger, and is that intentional? Not really. It's pretty, you know, the next ones aren't going to be like that. So it's not a trend. It's just a few data points. Yes.
For your historical books, what is your research process look like? Do you read a lot of original sources or academic sources, lay-oriented sources, or any of it?
It kind of depends on the period I'm reading about, but for example, for the Baroque cycle, you kind of have a few categories. You've got more academic histories. You've got the actual books that people wrote back then, which are all got put on microfilm a long time ago, and now you can get them digitally. So you can read any book that was published in that era. And then, you know, the hard part and the fun part in a lot of ways is trying to find the more down and dirty populist kind of stuff that isn't necessarily quite as academic or as elevated. Try to get the biggest diversity of sources possible, I guess. Okay, seated, yes. What kind of
weather?
Well, I live in Seattle. The question is, what kind of weather inspires me? When do I like to write? I write usually in the morning after breakfast for a couple of hours, and then after I stop, my brain kind of diesels for another hour or so, and I jot down little notes. But the rest of the day, I try to do something unrelated to take my mind off of it. But morning, when it's raining, is that's it for me. Yeah, standing up by the bookcase.
Your description of Dubois, a scientist who can communicate, reminded me of the Alan Alda Institute for Communicating Science. It made me think, can you talk a little bit about how much real-life organizations and things like that influence you, and maybe a few examples in your writing?
The Alan Alda Institute for Communicating About Science... real-life institutions?
Yeah, how do you influence you in your writing?
Wow. How do real-life institutions affect me in my writing? I don't know. I mean, institutions is a pretty broad term, right? You got nonprofits, you got universities, schools, you've got hospitals, you've got social clubs. I don't know. I mean, that's just a part of the overall scene that we live in. And I just try to, take in as much as I can, I guess, and see all the different kinds of organizations that are out there. So, yes, orange shirt.
Yeah, the take in as much as you can. How do you balance analog life with digital life? You have an analog hobby or habit that takes you away from the digital world altogether.
How do you balance the analog and the digital life, and do I have an analog hobby that takes me away from digital stuff? I like to make things. Unfortunately, making things is becoming more and more digital. So It's like, oh, I'm going to get away from the computer and make something. And then I'm there like working on a CAD program. But then I do martial arts as exercise. So I guess that would be my main thing is doing various kinds of sword-related martial arts stuff as a social thing and as a way to get some exercise and because I think it's cool and fun.
Including Aikido?
I don't do Aikido, but some of what we do in the European martial arts traditions has a few things in common with Aikido. People discover a lot of the same ideas over and over again in Japan or China or Europe. So if you know Aikido and you study some of the European stuff, you're like, oh, I've seen that before, you know. So, yes, sir. Yeah.
Do you use writing new books as an excuse to go on interesting vacations?
Do I use writing books as an excuse to go on interesting vacations? I've heard that that works great. A lot of the places I write about are not exactly vacation sites, but some of them are. I mean, no, there's no doubt about it. The tricky thing is that when I go to a place, I see 90% of what I'm going to see in about the first 24 hours. And by the time I get to 48 hours, I'm done. And hanging around for a week isn't going to add a whole lot more. And you get into a problem of then wanting to use all of the stuff you saw. And you can't. There's you see too much to fit it all in. So I tend to do these kind of like SEAL Team 6, insertion missions where I just sort of go in, look around for a day, and get out. But I will say this, that I'm no good at being a tourist for a tourist's sake. I hate that. I'm bored and I'm restless. But when I go there for a specific task, because I've got a reason to be there, I find it much more enjoyable to travel. Young lady by the pillar.
What's been the most difficult book for you to write and why?
What's been the most difficult book for me to write and why? Well, I mean, this is going to sound like sort of a cop-out answer, but the first one that got published, just because I had no idea what I was doing. And so had to go back and do a lot of editing and fixing. Actually, the one after that never got published, deservedly. And it also was difficult for the same reason. I didn't know how to do it, and so I was working in a really inefficient way. I was producing huge amounts of material, a lot of which was of low quality, and then I would have to go through and laboriously edit out, excavate the good stuff from all the bad stuff, and, that's a terrible way to do it. Yes, Black Hoodie.
So my favorite part of Mandatum was the configuration space, the hand space.
Okay.
But I had a tough time describing that to other people.
This gentleman requests assistance in explaining configuration space to people. Well, of course, obviously it's not my idea at all. It's a particular way of doing math that goes back at least to Lagrange. Julian Barbour, Barbour, he's an independent English physicist, and he wrote a kind of great big sort of forbidding book about the discovery of dynamics. It was supposed to be volume one of a two-volume set. And then he wrote one called The End of Time, which is more accessible, a shorter book, aimed at more of a general audience. And so it's basically him sort of, okay, look, I'm just going to get to the point. Have you seen that one?
No.
Okay, check that out. That is kind of a pretty decent recommendation. And then I think in the Feynman lectures, there's some stuff about it, but that's more, that's, you know, the smartest guy in the world talking to Caltech students, so it's maybe not what you want. Let's see. Okay, way in the back section there, striped, vertically striped shirt.
We touched on Snow Crash being a development hell.
Yeah.
Any of your other properties been optioned for television or film?
Most of them have been optioned or something like that. At one, but he's asking whether some of my other books have been optioned for TV or film, and most of them have been gone through at least some amount of that at different times. You know, somebody will get a option for a year and a half and work on it, and then obviously nothing's actually come of it yet, but this stuff kind of rattles around all the time. There's two very close to each other, so let's start with green. Something, Colorado State. Yeah, okay. And then, I didn't quite catch the last part of it.
Sorry.
That's okay.
In particular, I was wondering about Vonnegut's
Galapagos. Oh, okay. When I was writing 70s, was I influenced by other literary works, and in particular by Vonnegut's Galapagos? Well, you know, I at some level, I'm, and again, this will sound like a sort of cop-outy sort of answer, but I'm kind of influenced by all science fiction that came before me, but I wouldn't say anything more strongly than another thing. I haven't read Vonnegut's Galapagos. Sounds like I should. I guess I'm... What I'm doing in Seven Eves, if you want to think about it that way, is more kind of responding to some of the big science fictional universes that we've seen on TV and movies and books for a long time that feature big spaceships going out to explore remote planets, which are seen as kind of the frontier. And in this case, I'm trying to turn that around. And instead of ships, we've got habitats around the Earth. And the alien planet is the Earth. People, now I'm spoiling it, but people go back to the Earth and find things there. I'm also interested in the way that both fantasy and science fiction universes tend to have multiple humanoid species that all are kind of similar. They can interbreed. In Tolkien you've got elves and dwarves and goblins and hobbits, and in Star Trek you've got Klingons and Vulcans and Ferengi and so on. They all speak English. You know, Spock is half human, half Vulcan, even though Vulcans have radically different blood chemistry. But somehow that works. It's a common, it's almost a universal feature of fantasy and science fiction to have those. And I'm kind of interested in that. I'm trying to interrogate that a little bit. So. Okay, now, right? Yeah. Yeah. What music was I influenced by when I was writing this book? Actually, this is one where I didn't listen to much music. Yeah, I don't know why. Probably couldn't find any music depressing enough. It's a good question because in the past I've tended to have like a soundtrack for books that I'm writing, but. Maybe a few classical pieces that are mentioned about halfway through the book, but other than that, not much. There was, okay, way in the back with your index finger up. Yeah.
To what degree do your personal beliefs influence your writing?
To what degree do my personal beliefs influence my writing? Hopefully as little as possible, because I don't want... to write books that that seem like, you know, a screed for a particular philosophy or, you know, a political point of view or whatever. I'm not to say, I mean, you can read any book and find in it obvious traces of what the writer thinks. So I'm not claiming that that's not true of me, but, what I'm trying to do is kind of look around the world and have the clearest perceptions that I can and translate those over and not have everything be slanted in any particular direction. So don't know if I succeed. So yes, on the aisle. Yeah. Oh wait. Well, there's two of you right in front of each other. So go ahead, and then the gentleman in the blue shirt is next.
I was wondering if you had a favorite historical figure to write about, and on the other hand, if any of the historical figures you've written about you found yourself struggling with or dreading.
Do I have a favorite historical figure to write about, and or conversely, are there others that I dreaded writing about? Well, I had fun writing about Leibniz. I a lot of fun writing about Robert Hooke. So some of the early scientists, I enjoyed writing about. I'm struggling with. I don't know. I sort of believe that if you read enough, if you learn enough about any one person, you should be able to get to a place where you can portray them. I don't know. So, next.
So in a lot of end-of-world fiction, mm-hmm. other than the very core characters, the end is coming and everyone sort of gives up and stops going to work and the world starts falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't seem to be the case in 70s. It seems like pretty much everyone sort of works sort of to the last minute. I mean, we don't see it explicitly, but it's sort of implied. And I wonder what you thought from a psychological perspective, if that was how you really thought people would behave.
Yeah, in Seven Eves, the end of the world's coming, everybody knows it, but instead of just going crazy or doing nothing, they sort of keep going to the end for the most part. So this is a question about that. Well, it's a couple things. One is that sort of like my reading of history and of current events suggests to me that when disasters happen, when there's a war or an earthquake or whatever, that by and large, that's what people do. I mean, there's always exceptions, but a lot of people sort of rise to the occasion. And I think we're kind of wired to rise to the occasion. And so I wanted to reflect that in the book. I didn't want to I didn't want to spend hundreds of pages writing about people like knifing each other or going bananas in the streets. That kind of explains the approach that I took. When I was a kid in Iowa, there were some big floods in another part of the state, and it was one of the few events that was significant enough to draw the network news crews to Iowa in those days. This is before the caucuses. And so we had the rare experience of being able to turn on the news and see a network news broadcast from Iowa. And I can remember some of the reporters saying that there hadn't been any looting. And all of the Iowa people were kind of looking at each other like, looting? Why would there be looting? Who would loot? When did looting enter this conversation? You know, and so that always kind of stuck with me. Standing. The Mongoliad Project. Well, it's it depends on is the Mongoliad Project still alive? Is the question. Started with an e-published book, and that became a three-volume series. And then to that, we added two more paper volumes and a bunch of side quests and stories. And we've got, coming out of that universe, we've had several different graphic novel series. The most, and I'm writing on one of those called Cimarronin. And so the we've got five issues out of Cimarronin, and the sixth and last is where I think we just approved the lettering a couple days ago. So that'll be out pretty soon. There's another series in that world called Suffragitsu, which is about it's about suffragettes in Edwardian England learning martial arts. So it's alive in that sense. It's not. I don't think we have other irons in the fire currently, but you never know. So yes, in the maroon shirt. Yeah, you.
Mm-hmm. And I started reading Seven Eves, and I'm not done with it at all, or very far, really. But I was wondering what role you think space travel sort of plays in humanity's future, and how do you convince people it's okay to send nuclear reactors into the atmosphere and stuff?
What role does space travel play in humanity's future, and how do you convince people it's okay to send nuclear reactors into orbit? Well, in the book, that part, the last part is really easy because the Earth's going to be destroyed anyway. So it's okay, let's send up some nuclear reactors. What's the worst that could happen? Of course, nuclear payloads go up all the time. The radio thermal, generators go up, not true reactors. The future of space, a big topic. It's still expensive. Various people are working on making it less horrendously expensive. It's a hard place to go. I think, it's easy to underestimate the discomfort and the physical danger that people are in when they're up there from cosmic rays and the long-term effects of zero G and so on. So my take on it is that we're going to have to build stuff. We're going to have to build places for people to live that are sheltered from cosmic rays and that can give them simulated gravity by spinning things, and we can't possibly send enough stuff up from the ground to do that, and so we're going to have to get it up there. We're going to have to do asteroid mining, basically. So for me, the most plausible path that makes sense is asteroid mining, which, as you know, is a big part of this book. There is an asteroid mining company. Actually, you Denver people should be all over this. There's an asteroid mining company in Seattle called Planetary Resources that I worked with. Got some help from them on the book. So people are working on it, and I think we'll get there. So how are we doing on time? Just one more. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
As far as the premise of the book, how much artistic license did you take on the behavior of the moon rocks, the time scale, the severity?
Yeah.
And if you didn't take much, what are your sources?
I did take much. So the question is, the basic scenario has to do with the pieces of the moon and what happens to them and how long it takes for that to happen and what the results are. And she's asking whether I, actually kind of modeled that out and did legitimate scientific work on that. And I didn't. I would like to. I think it would be kind of a cool project. But once I had the basic idea for the thing, I just thought, okay, I'm just this is just going to be a given in the book, and I'm just going to write it, you know, and later we can find out how wrong I was. But no. So I think that ends the question and answer phase. We're going to go to signing now.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.